Welcome back to the Scaling Tech Podcast, the podcast for software engineering leaders. I'm your host, Aaron Syme. In today's episode, we're continuing our discussions about AI and software development. I'm speaking with Glenn Wasson, who is a data scientist who serves as the administrator of analytics and performance measurement at the University of Virginia Health System. He has a PhD in computer science from the University of Virginia, and he's used data to creatively solve problems in a range of industries, including healthcare, national defense, energy, and higher education. I've personally worked with Glenn on data-driven applications, and I've learned a lot from him, so I'm delighted to have him here today to discuss AI and predictive analytics. Welcome to the Scaling Tech Podcast, Glenn.
Thanks, Aaron. Glad to be here.
Welcome to the Scaling Tech Podcast, where we help you manage your growing engineering team. Through expert interviews, we help you navigate the challenges of leading, hiring, growing, and nurturing your tech team to deliver the value your customers demand. Brought to you by AgilityFeet.com, experts in staffing engineering teams in Latin America for clients globally.
It's wonderful to have you here. And thanks for joining me in person, which is an unusual way for us to do the Scaling Tech Podcast, but definitely fun since we're here in the same city of Charlottesville, Virginia. I want to start with a high-level question, Glenn. What's your definition of AI, and does the current state of technology warrant such a grandiose term as artificial intelligence?
Right. So really, AI is this big umbrella term for systems that solve problems in a way that reminds us of us, right? So in a way that feels human-like to other people. So it's a bit of a philosophical definition, but it sort of avoids having to define exactly what intelligence is, which is a notoriously sticky issue. We don't have to argue about whether AI or people. It allows us to ascribe intelligence to what systems we want. And that's not so much a sort of diss of the state of the art, because the important thing there is how easy it is for someone to interact with a system that sort of acts the way they would anticipate a person doing, right? So you can really get better, user experience, let's say, out of such systems.
I love the phrase that you use there of a system that reminds us of us. And I think you said that, you know, that helps to avoid defining what intelligence is, because, I mean, defining intelligence among humans is hard enough sometimes.
Right. Exactly.
And so then to define that in a system that we create, that's a fascinating spin. And I really love that term because it really emphasizes that this is something that that we're creating for better or worse. So, so it is sort of, it reminds us as it not only does it remind us of us, but it's probably going to have a lot of the same built-in biases and problems that we have ourselves, because we only know how to create human intelligence. Like the only intelligence we understand, rather, is human intelligence. Mm-hmm. And we don't fully understand that. So that's a great definition of it. There is a lot of terms that are used in this, and I think it's beneficial to have an expert like yourself define some of them for us to start, because it is easy to mix them up, and I'm sure I do all the time. So terms like AI, machine learning, and LLMs, a lot of people use them almost interchangeably. Right. So can you give us a little context on the differences and then maybe how it works?
Right. So we talked about AI as this sort of big umbrella term. Machine learning then is a subset of AI, where we're creating systems that try to determine patterns from examples. Mm-hmm. So really useful in situations where it's hard to write the algorithm or the rule set that governs how to solve a problem, but we can definitely judge any particular solution to be, right, wrong, good, bad, right? And so if you can present a whole bunch of positive and negative examples to a system that can try and derive what the rules are from that, That's machine learning in a nutshell. And then the large language model, a particular technique whereby we train essentially this giant probability machine on all the text we can find. And its job is to say, given all the words that have been used up till now, what's the most likely next word?
Yeah.
Right? So if, you know, the sentence is, he barked like a, you know, the most likely next word is dog.
Right.
Not fish or something.
Right.
But in a different context, right, you might have some weird sentence construction where, you know, they say the fish made an unusual barking sound when they leapt out of the water. And so, you know, now it might be, you know, he barked like a, you know, now maybe fish makes sense. So it's this context-dependent probability model.
Yeah, yeah. And so the probability comes in on the LLM side in terms of anticipating what the next word is. It's doing this very sophisticated analysis of predicting the next word in each thing that it's doing. And so that's where we also get to the challenge, right, with whether or not AI can create anything new, right, or whether it can just sort of regurgitate reformulate existing data and existing human insights in a way that maybe we hadn't thought of before. There can still be helpful things in there, right? But it's not necessarily new. Is that a fair statement? Would you agree with that?
Yeah. So this is a great philosophical question too, right? Can it create? We tend to think of the answers that we get back from ChatGPT or Claude or any of these things as sort of some kind of average of all the things that have been said on a particular topic,
right?
The system doesn't really understand in any deep way what you're asking.
Yeah.
But it knows what the most likely response is, which means it's going to be something that somebody said before or some amalgam.
Yeah.
That can be really useful in a domain where you don't have a lot of expertise and you need the summary.
Mm-hmm.
But it really depends on how you want to define creativity, whether that system could ever create something new.
Yeah.
And certainly when it's trying to create the average, if you will, of all of these things, it's probably not pushing the boundaries, which tends to be where creativity is.
Right. Yeah. And the other thing too, that I often catch myself, you know, mid saying things like this around creativity and innovation with AI, is that even in humans, all creativity and innovation is basically built on past people's ideas too, right? Mm-hmm. We're always, you know, the most humble scientists will say things like, you know, on the shoulder of giants and, you know, before me and that sort of thing. So, again, you know, especially if AI reminds us of us, it's only fair that its level of innovation can only be built on what we've done also, in a way.
Right, right. Well, and there's a sort of theory of creativity where what is really happening is people are combining parts of things they've seen before, mm-hmm. just in an unusual way. And so they're reusing things that are sort of already out there, which the AI in theory could have access to as well. And so it's just a question of whether the LLM technique will cause it to combine those pieces in an unexpected way, or will it do the most expected thing? Because the probability model said that that's what it should do.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, you and I are both of an appropriate age to, I won't say what age, but an appropriate age to remember debates around, like, can AI ever play chess? Could an AI ever play a chess master? And in other conversations you and I have had before, you've said to me that in the past, we just couldn't conceive of searching a state space of this size. And so it made it easy for us to assume that an AI could never beat a chess master, but now they can, right? AI can. So if you know, people in general were kind of wrong to be skeptical in the past of whether AI could beat a chess master, how wrong are we likely to be about the future of AI? And maybe expand a little bit too on what you meant, you know, when you talk about like searching a state space of this size and how that, you know, fits into this concept of machine learning and LLMs.
You know, I think if you're asking almost any question about how wrong are we about likely to be about the future, you know, the answer is very, right? Predictions are hard, especially about the future.
Right, right.
So in the past, you know, the number of positions on a chessboard is like more than grains of sand on the beach kind of a thing. And so people just couldn't clearly we can't search that,
right?
Right. We don't have the computational horsepower to do that. And so we try to do what people normally do. You know, we are a whole bag of hacks about how to deal with the complexity of the world, and sort of knowledge, wisdom, experience, all these things represent techniques that we have for like not having to think about every possible chess move.
Right.
Right. But just the ones that are relevant in the situation we're in. And so it took until really like the IBM Deep Blue experiment for computation to have gotten to a certain place. Mm-hmm. And then people realize how to harness that in a time efficient way. And then you get into a situation where you can sort of brute force through, if not all the state space, a really big portion of it beyond what the human can do. Right. And so that's where you can really, you know, beat them at their own game, some part of the state space that their knowledge and wisdom doesn't cover.
Yeah.
But that you can see.
Yeah. And going back to our previous discussion around creativity and innovation, I mean, one of the things in AI playing chess is sometimes it does come up with effectively a new strategy too, that, you know, so it's not just it can search this large state space faster than a human can, and so maybe make the better choice as a result, but sometimes does come up with things that at least appear to be, you know, something new,
right,
in a way to play, you know, because it maybe it doesn't have the same biases that others do. But but I want to say, you just used a phrase that I love, and next time I make a mistake, I'm going to tell somebody, I'm just a big bag of hacks. Like, look. What can I do?
We've gone beyond a big bag of hacks.
We're all just a big bag of hacks.
Indeed.
So in the past, many times, you know, we have been very wrong about the future from a, I guess, pessimistic perspective of saying, well, AI could never beat a chess master. Mm. We've also been very wrong optimistically too, right?
Right.
I mean,
right.
Also, people of our age remember watching flying cars on the Jetsons cartoons as kids and wonder why we still don't have those. Much more recently, I think many of us would have expected that we would have, you know, fully self-driving cars now, and we don't. So these things are not easy, you know, and we can be both too pessimistic and too optimistic about them. So, you know, when you think about something like a self-driving car, with things like that, I wonder how much is that sort of problem? Is it a technological problem that we just, you know, it's still just harder than we think?
Right.
You know, most technical things are harder than we thought they were going to be. But the leap that we've seen in things like ChatGPT and Claude has been so dramatic that now we start to believe, well, maybe things are happening faster than we thought, yet we still can't figure out how to get self-cars, you know, self-driving cars to be widespread. So is that a technological problem, or is it more of, you know, say like a societal problem or just a change management problem that, you know, self-driving cars would work better if we could get all human-driven cars off the road, and then they would have a discrete set of rules to play by instead of humans out there who don't play by the rules always? Or, you know, is it a societal problem of some kind? Like, how do we... Because AI affects society so much, I guess, is my long-winded question here. How do we know how much is technical, how much is a societal problem?
Yeah, and it doesn't have to be, like you say, it could be both of those things in different measure, right? So like societally, we have yet to really decide who is to blame when something goes wrong in the car domain. Let's stick with that, right?
Sure.
Is it the maker who wrote bad software? Is it the operator who didn't stay attentive to the fact that they're supposed to be able to grab the wheel?
Yeah.
So those are questions. On the technical side, I think a lot of the evaluation of these things, like they're super good driving in situations where all the other cars are driven by people.
Right.
Right. And so you could imagine that as, oh my God, they're people. They could do anything. How can we prepare for that? On the other hand, they can also bail you out of situations that you didn't even realize, AI out of situations that they didn't even realize. Right. Like these, I've heard the term contingency sponge used, right? Like people can soak up a lot of weirdness and do something with it.
Yeah.
And maybe that helps, you know, the AI out. So, if you eliminated all the human-driven cars and you engineered the environment, mm-hmm. You could imagine that the AIs would work, and probably, you'd need like some single vendor to make that happen and whatever. But that's really unlikely, right? Yeah. You're not going to get there. And so we have to figure out what happens. What are the sort of system level effects that happen when there's a ton of AI vehicles out there that are reacting to each other?
Right.
And what happens? So recent story from San Francisco, these people calling and complaining about these cars that were just like honking all night. And it turns out it's a whole bunch of Waymos in a parking lot together honking at each other because they think it's like somebody backing out that's about to like not pay attention and run into them.
Right.
But they're all kind of frozen in this gridlock, like honking at each other, trying to get into these spaces that they're supposed to go to.
Which is a hilarious thought, but certainly something we see in gridlock with humans too. So maybe they do behave like humans, right. illogically as well. This thought just popped into my head too, as you talk about that too. And when we compare like AI and human intelligence, I mean, I'm definitely no expert on how the human brain works, and to the degree that we even understand that, even
right.
the people who do study right. this, right? They talk sometimes about, I think it's the book Thinking Fast and Thinking Slow, where the author talks about like, I want to say the phrase he used was like type one and type two, but basically like your subconscious and your conscious brain. And so all the things that we do unconsciously,
right,
the things that we think fast about that lead to good and bad decisions. I
mean, those are the hacks that evolution gave us.
Those are the bag of hacks that we have, right? Exactly. And sometimes there are hacks that no longer fit in a modern context and lead to problems. Sometimes they're hacks that, bail us out of that, that car accident where we react and
right.
and survive, but don't really know how we knew to react in that way that quickly, right? The sort of off the top of my head thought here too is that when we talk about AI systems, we're talking about implementing them often as if they are a single system, but our brain is sort of like two systems, this fast and slow part.
Yeah.
And so, maybe there's another architecture to come of, how do you deal with different types of thought patterns, and you're not just feeding it all into one LLM. I don't know. That's a random thought and probably erroneous in a ton of ways.
Well, but I mean, I think even today, a chatbot that you talk to is distinct from the LLM that it uses behind the scenes, right?
True.
And so it's not necessary that it actually work the way your brain works. It just needs to give the appearance of, right? Like that's what's important here. So
yeah.
There's all kinds of models inside of the chatbot that are not part of the LLM that are trying to condition what goes into the LLM and what comes back out of it. So I think we already see that.
Yeah, you're right. Absolutely. Yeah. As there's nothing new under the sun. I thought I had an original thought there, and actually we're already doing that. And we'll talk more in a minute probably about like retrieval augmented generation, which I guess you could say is that like slow part of the brain, right? The incorporating other sources and specialized data and things that we can more easily track. Where did that thought come from? But let's shift to regulated environments and the use of AI there, because with your experience in industries like healthcare and national defense, I think you can bring a unique perspective and for us to kind of start to think about how do we take these philosophical ideas and apply them to the real world. And sometimes the real world is a highly regulated environment, and we obviously can deal with this to a degree, because although we don't have perfect self-driving cars yet, as your parking lot example shows, we are still allowing them in many situations. And so what are some analogous situations in, say, healthcare or other regulated industries where we can apply AI, but we do need some guardrails around it somehow? And how do we do that?
Yeah, so there's a lot of different ways to use AI in, let's say, healthcare, short of the kind of most worrying situation, maybe like the AI providing a diagnosis or
right.
a, treatment plan. There's lots of back office functions, HR functions, those kinds of things that go into any business, but that wouldn't really impact at the patient level. Mm-hmm. But something that's really exciting is this application they call ambient listening, So in the old world, right, before the electronic medical record, you would go to your doctor and you would look them in the eye, so to speak, and have a conversation. And maybe they would jot a few things down on this piece of paper that they would put in a folder. You know, that thing was your, that thing was your chart. And then the medical record era comes along and you get this shift. And so now your doctor is most likely looking at a screen when they're talking to you, right? And they're clicking like mad because there's a whole bunch of like standard things that they want to fill in. And maybe at the end they get to talking to you narratively, but then they write down what they remember often later.
Right.
Because they're, you know, off to the next patient during the day. And so they're trying to sort of complete these charts at a later time, which is, you know, often sort of burning them out as well. So the ambient listening idea is you just put a microphone in the room, you record what the physician and the patient say to each other. And then, you know, text-to-speech is sort of a thing we can do. There are some tricky ways to actually do that in the modern style. But then the AI can look over that text. It can extract the answers to the standard questions and sort of fill those parts in. And then the narrative part of that encounter, it can create a summary of it, right? Because the dialogue may not be the most like succinct description of what we actually talked about.
Right.
But put all that, you know, put all that together for the physician. And so the doctor can just be focused on you.
Yeah.
And there are some places where this problem has been, you know, solved in the past with another person, right? You put this person called a scribe in the room, and they're sort of doing this function. But it can actually be really challenging to find scribes. Like a lot of industries struggle to find people to work in these kind of entry level positions, and so they're dealing without. And so having this ambient listening technology is a way for AI to be really assistive without trying to kind of muscle in on the doctor's domain.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's a fascinating concept because it also gets at what I think is the higher trend, the more important trend beyond the hype of AI, which is how the headline grabbing stories that we think about are things, you know, around like AI replacing, insert whatever job title you want,
right?
Almost every job title can have a headline like that if you imagine AI broadly enough or capable enough. But the reality is, and almost, I think the more likely outcome in almost any of those scenarios is that it's augmenting those humans and it's changing the role, right? So it's not replacing the doctor, it's augmenting them by helping them be more hands-off keyboard during a patient meeting, or it's helping the software developer write better code, or it's helping the customer service agent to better access company knowledge bases and better understand what the customer's asking for, or maybe even help translate that both directions in real time. You know, like all these things that help us be more efficient and augment our human capabilities in amazing ways, but doesn't replace us, you know, because there's always still that role there. So yeah, I think that's a great example to use. And I think a really, really fascinating example because it's not only helping the doctor potentially get their hands off the keyboard and be more attentive to the patient, but then without giving a diagnosis, you still open the possibility there that it will assist the doctor by saying, well, you know, they talked about these things, so this is the most common, say, prescription for that, or this is, you know, these are diagnoses you should consider, right? That, you know, it's not telling the patient what the diagnosis is. It's not writing a script for a prescription.
Right.
So that, but it may help prompt the doctor
to something,
kind of
another
slip their mind,
level
right?
of decision support.
Right.
You know, the sort of lowest level is just the summary of what was talked about. You know, they said that they have this problem. They experienced, you know, it in this way. They have this level of pain. They have these sort of social determinants. And the physician can still turn that into a diagnosis, but it was helpful just to boil the ocean down to those facts.
Yeah.
And then there's the other level of saying, well, these facts are consistent with, you know, this or that out of the giant body of medical knowledge that we can feed into these things.
Yeah.
And so you certainly want to have a human in that loop.
Yep.
But it's a really interesting question in a lot of places, how the human machine system should work.
Right.
Right. And so if you're, you know, in the self-driving car situation, it's hard because the machine is like mostly right. And so you're waiting for those small percentage of times when you need to help it out.
Yeah.
And people aren't good at that. They aren't
hard
good
to stay attentive.
Maintaining that level of attention when you mostly don't need it.
Yeah.
You know, not even to mention like the sort of practice with particular skills that maybe you don't get if the machine's mostly right.
Right.
So there are definitely questions around sort of how do you keep people in the problem solving loop and not just sort of depending upon the machine.
I want to take a moment to tell you about our sponsor, WebRTC Ventures. At WebRTC Ventures, our teams are experts in building live video into your web or mobile applications. We've literally built hundreds of them. We have over a decade of experience using both open source and commercial media servers in a wide range of industries, including telehealth, edtech, broadcasting, and more. We also publish a lot of helpful tips and industry interviews on our website and our YouTube channel. So be sure to check out webrtc.ventures and we can help you build, scale, and deploy your video solution. Glenn, we've talked about some really interesting healthcare scenarios so far. Even if the LLM is not helping us to make a diagnosis, if the ambient listening is more listening and working as a scribe than diagnosing, we still obviously want to make sure that it's as accurate as possible. And so when we're dealing with AI-based systems, how do you test and validate something that, especially things that don't really show their work very much right now, or, you know, or can they show their work in the future? So how do you go about that?
Yeah, so I think you're starting to see a lot of work in the show your work space, mm-hmm. right? So just a fun example, in ChatGPT 3.5, you could ask it the question, how many R's are there in the word strawberry?
Uh-huh.
And it would say two, right? Because this is like a common thing humans do. They remember the two R's in berry and they forget the third one, right? And so you train off the internet, you know, maybe this is what you expect. But ChatGPT-4 does something really interesting, which is it recognizes that this is a question that it could compute the answer to.
Yeah.
And so rather than asking the LLM, you know, this sort of question directly, let's say, as a question in English, it asks it to write a piece of code to compute the answer. And so it'll say three and it'll show you the like line of Python that it wrote to do that.
Yeah.
Right. So that's like both really smart that it recognized the type of question, which is sort of this, you know, what's the modeling going on inside the chatbot independent of the LLM.
Yeah.
And then it gives you an answer. In a lot of other domains, like specialist domains, right, people need references. Like, mm-hmm. why is it that you think this is true?
Right.
And in sort of old ChatGPT, for example, it wasn't very good at this.
Right.
Right. Today, you can actually ask it to give you references, and like 4 and the even the free version of 4 will sort of try to do this automatically. That doesn't mean the references are necessarily good, but at least you can check, right? It gives you a method of checking.
Yeah.
And I think you also come to realize how dynamic the internet is, because it's going to refer to things that you can no longer, you know, where the link doesn't work anymore.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. Interesting. So as it, for situations where it can be calculation based, for example, you know, over time, it can certainly show us more of its work, its logical process, and then where possible, showing sources and allowing us to be able to validate that. So those are two methods. If you're kind of tuning a custom model for, you know, your use case in healthcare or something, and it's you know, how do you go about seeing did it pull the correct summary from this vast treasure trove of data? I mean, you know, you don't want to go through and have to necessarily read all 50,000 or 5 million pages it read to determine that too. Are there other ways that you, you know, then in with large data sets in particular, that you can know if it's doing the right thing?
So I think one thing that's important is to figure out what the, you know, definition of good is.
Right.
Right. So it's not just, obviously you need a certain amount of correctness, mm-hmm. right, which itself can be something you need to struggle to define sometimes. But I think there's also some other properties that you need to have in your AI system in order to say, like, you know, this is doing the job that I need it to do, right?
Yeah.
So correctness is one thing, but we would call it safety with respect to the patient. So, you know, your system, yes, it does what you want it to do. It also doesn't do things you told it not to do. And all those things that you forgot to specify, whatever it does is kind of innocuous, right? So it you know, the sort of do no harm idea. You need it to be secure, but maybe that's not the right word. It's more like it needs to preserve privacy. Mm-hmm. Right. So if you tell, for example, the LLM some facts, it won't regurgitate them to somebody who's not supposed to receive those facts. Right?
Right.
Nor will it answer questions from the wrong person. If I ask it for health information and I'm not your doctor, right? It shouldn't tell me.
Same sort of role-based security we would build into applications in other ways.
Right. Yeah. And who knows what new channels to leak there might be there.
Right.
And then another thing in healthcare in particular, we look for the judgments to be what we would call equitable.
Okay, yeah.
So a lot of evidence that maybe in the past, the diagnoses and treatments were not the same for people of different races, ethnicities, you know, different primary languages, you know, these sort of various categories. And if you train your machine on these potentially flawed diagnoses created in the past, you just recreate the same situation. And so you need to, you know, you need to think hard about what correct is or let's say good AI is in your situation before you can even get to, well, how can we try and make sure that the AI is good as it's operating.
Right, right. Yeah. So as has always been the case in computer science, you know, with a little bit of like garbage in, garbage out, right? We have to be very careful in fine-tuning those data sets that we're going to train against. And if they were created on, you know, old medical research that was only done on one particular demographic, it may not apply to all and come up with an equitable, you know, result for them. So, that makes me think about there must be a tremendous amount of governance in how, like, you structure a team around predictive analytics and AI in healthcare, where it's, you know, it's your role as like a data scientist is important, and you're of course keeping these principles in mind, but there must be other people involved as well in different processes that you go through in order to try and help validate these things and get other eyeballs on it before it's used in a clinical setting.
I think broadly this is usually called AI governance, right? Yep. How does an organization know what AI is running in there and have some assurance that that is the right AI,
right?
That they want to have. So one of my jobs as a leader of a bunch of technical teams is to try and make sure that evaluation is carried out, that it's, you know, principled. Mm-hmm. This can be easy in some sense to do on things you create yourself because you've got all the parts and you can open the box and you can like totally figure it out, right? Whereas a product that you're buying, it can be very difficult to actually understand what's going on inside the box. And to the degree that the vendor community isn't used to answering questions like I just, you know, laid out, you can get variable responses when you try and probe in those areas. So I think at least in healthcare, there's a lot of awareness around this now. And a lot of systems are sort of looking at those properties that I described, and trying to lay out what their value system is such that you could create some set of questions that probe those values with respect to any particular product that you're either making or buying. So you can make an informed decision when you put it in. But of course, that's never enough because these systems are evolving, typically, right? And so you have to have some way to return to the question of, you know, is the system still good by the values we've laid out?
Yeah, absolutely. So let's talk about another acronym used a lot in AI and in the architecture of AI-based systems, RAG, Retrieval Augmented Generation. And if you know, maybe tell us a little bit about what that is and how it's used and how that can help in a regulated environment in particular, or with things like patient privacy and, you know, in a healthcare environment too.
Yeah, so retrieval augmented generation is basically the idea that the LLM was trained on, let's say, the internet, mm-hmm. but circa some particular time, right?
Right.
And it's expensive to retrain these things, and so they're not going to be training it every day, mm-hmm. right? And so a way to provide context to the machine, right? So one of the things that we know is sort of people often say the more you talk to it, the better it gets.
Right.
But really what's happening there is you're providing a bunch of context that
yeah.
it's using in its predictions about, you know, what words to say or
yeah.
what words to output. So, God, where was I? This is the part you'll edit out.
So how do you, we'll edit that part out. Don't worry. So in a healthcare setting, with retrieval augmented generation.
Okay, I'm back.
Yeah. No, I'll start over there.
Okay.
But yeah, I'll kind of ask like where you're going to use that. So that's really helpful, Glenn. I appreciate it. And so when we use retrieval augmented generation in a healthcare setting, for example, like what sort of data would you be bringing in to help augment the existing knowledge that LLM was trained on?
Right. So there's sort of two ways to think about this, and you can be doing both of them simultaneously. One is to get real-time data.
Mm-hmm.
So the RAG paradigm is you create the context around your question by taking your question to the old school internet, let's say, right? And just like give me all the responses to that question, and then I'm going to feed that as context to the LLM and say, like, summarize this into a cohesive narrative,
right?
That answers my question. And so that gets around the fact that the data that the LLM might have been trained on is old.
Yep.
But the other thing you could do with that is add specialized knowledge that may not have been part of the internet-based training set,
mm-hmm.
right? So if you have private data, for example, you can create the context through RAG, feed that into an LLM, which is really, you know, trained on how to, let's say, speak English, and that's what its job is. But the context data is something that you're loading at question time.
Yeah.
And so that's a really powerful thing to the degree that the, you know, language that's being used in a particular business domain is like English.
Yeah.
You just need the sort of technical terms of, you know, terms of art that would have come out of private data.
To what degree are you in a RAG scenario, are you using like individual patient information? You know, can you do that within like, you know, in the US, the HIPAA rules, and you know, how do you handle that sort of
yeah.
information? Or are you always doing something that's more generic and then outside of the LLM integration in your application, you know, there's something that's more specific to the patient?
Right. I think people are generally not going to send PHI data into the public internet,
right?
So you're not going to use the stock GPT that you can get, but you can also stand up your own private instance
yeah.
of those things such that you have control over what's fed to it. And I know a number of health systems have done this kind of thing. One of the things that I think has been interesting about a lot of their experience is tremendous cost.
Yeah.
Right? Like these, you know, in the old days, a predictive model, maybe it was expensive to train because you had to look at millions of possibilities, but then you boiled the ocean down to like the top 10 or 12.
Yeah.
Right? And so executing a model, once you figured it out, was easy.
Right.
But now there's a trillion parameters.
Yeah.
And so every evaluation of the model uses a lot of compute.
Yeah.
Right? So the people who are really making money at this stuff today are
the vendors.
Are the vendors of these data centers.
Yeah.
So you really have to be mindful of sort of what is the value that you can get back. Yeah. And so some people feel now that these sort of generalized question answerers, you know, they're fun, but they don't generate enough value to be to be worth their cost.
Yeah.
And so there's a real question about, like, should we train an LLM based on private data? So it's sort of like baked in. Mm-hmm. Is that a way to inject the sources into the training such that you can have variable trust based on, you know, where right. the information came from? A lot of different techniques to try and get around this
yeah.
sort of place that today these generalized systems seem stuck at.
Yeah. And so our audience of engineering leaders who are thinking about how to architect these things into their applications. So they're probably thinking right now about, well, do I go with a SaaS-based AI interface to an LLM? But if I do that, I can't send it PHI because that's, you know, going out into their public model and can be reused in the model essentially. Maybe if I do an open source LLM and do some training on it myself and run it in my own data center or run it in my own private cloud, then maybe I can do things with more sensitive data. But now maybe I'm paying a little less per compute than I would through a SaaS API, but I've still got a really expensive cloud bill or a really expensive data center. Plus, I've probably had to hire some extra data scientists and AI engineers to build all this and manage it for me. So there is a tremendous amount of cost in this and the different architectures to balance in it.
Well, and there's another balance point too, in that, you know, the scale of the model for ChatGPT is kind of beyond what anybody except a few tech companies and, you know, maybe some countries, right?
Right.
Could do.
Right.
Right. At the $1 billion cost to train, you know, the model, right?
Yeah.
It's sort of beyond what most people can do. And so what a lot of people are implementing is, instead of something with hundreds of billions to trillions of parameters, it's like the 70 billion parameter model that's open source. And so how good is that versus, you know, these other models? How good is all that stuff that we don't really talk about inside the chatbot versus, you know, what you could put together? And so it's a really interesting space to try and balance.
Yeah. Yeah. And as you said, this is a very dynamic space. And so as our time is running out here and we start to wrap up, I think one of the things I've certainly heard said to engineering leaders is, look, you know, you can't wait for the perfect architecture on this. Because no one knows it yet. We're still, you know, things are changing too much. We're all learning as we go. But you also can't wait for the potential benefits of this or to wait, to experiment with it. In other words, you need to dive into using AI and LLMs in your applications in some form
get
now.
What it's really good at.
And figure out what it's good at for your use case. Hopefully not come up with $1 million cloud compute bill in the process, but also experimenting a little bit with, you know, for what I want to do, what is this going to cost? Mm-hmm. And so therefore, what would it cost at scale? So, you know, that brings me kind of the question for you as a engineering leader of teams, you know, dealing with large data sets and regulated environments, how do you handle innovation in that? And what, you know, sort of advice would you give to others for managing teams that need to be innovative, working with innovative technologies, but it's everything is changing under their feet as they do it.
Right, right. So getting a situation where you can experiment for yourself is really key. So often for us, that's, we're far from clinical production, right? We're possibly even using fake data because we're really experimenting with the techniques as opposed to the results.
Sure.
And just trying to understand sort of what they're good at and not just what compute costs, but what engineering costs, right? Like how hard is it going to be to build and maintain? And would we be able to do this with the crew that we have, you know, sort of thing. So having a dev environment is like maybe one of the most important things you can do. And then for people who are kind of trying to bootstrap themselves. You know, we've been working in AI for a long time, but the large language models is sort of a new thing, right? And we didn't have people who are kind of dyed in the wool on that. And so you have to figure out sort of how to bootstrap enough knowledge that you can get to that experimental phase where you can sort of figure out, like, what can I make this do? What can I make this do for me? And that can be really hard if you're just reading a bunch of, you know, blog posts or whatever. I've found, you know, it's a sort of old school way, but I've found Coursera to be pretty useful on this in terms of kind of summarizing the state of that, but also like reminding you of things that we knew about AI, like long back, that still, you know, that still apply. And then depending upon what courses you're interested in, you know, they can go into like, well, here's a bunch of libraries, right? That you could try out, sort of get your feet wet.
All right. So check out those Coursera courses. Set up a dev environment and remember that this is all just a big bag of hacks. Have some fun, experiment, innovate, but watch out for those compute costs along the way. And preferably everything up until that point, you're doing all of it with fake data, not risking real patient data at that point. And then once you figure out what it is and what's feasible for your scenario, what's the right application of AI, not overusing it, then starting to work with, making sure that you're bringing in all of that governance around it that we talked about too. And so making sure that you're getting the right level of AI in that environment and taking care of things like in healthcare, patient privacy. So, all right.
Perfect summary. Like an AI might have said.
Maybe I am. Excellent. Well, Glenn, thank you so much for taking the time to be with me here on the Scaling Tech Podcast. Really appreciate your insights. So thanks so much for joining me today.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Aaron.
It was a pleasure.
Great.
Thank you.
Bye.
On behalf of the thousands of developers we've placed with our clients, I want to briefly tell you about our sponsor, Agility Feed. Agility Feed has been building nearshore agile teams for U.S. companies since 2010. We were an early pioneer in doing this sort of developer staffing. Our team can help you recruit talented software engineers and technical teams in Latin America. We'll handle all aspects of recruiting, contracting, and payments for you so you can focus on delivering great software. To learn more, check us out at agilityfeat.com. That's agilityfeat.com.